Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you the next two stories from Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson. Godliness, a Tale in Four Parts, Part 2, also concerning Jess Bentley, and Part 3, Surrender, concerning Louise Bentley. In these two stories, we get to know Jess a little bit more, and we learn about his daughter, Louise. Louise is a bit of a tragic figure. She never really had a chance, with no mother and a father who wanted a son. I love how Anderson places her into a global vision of women of the time. The latter half of the 1800s saw the women's rights movement gaining traction, but political rights and human rights are very different things. And now, Godliness, a Tale in Four Parts, Part 2, also concerning Jess Bentley. David Hardy of Winesburg, Ohio, was the grandson of Jess Bentley, the owner of Bentley Farms. When he was 12 years old, he went to the old Bentley place to live. His mother, Louise Bentley, the girl who came into the world on that night when Jesse ran through the fields, crying to God that he be given a son, had grown to womanhood on the farm and had married young John Hardy of Winesburg, who became a banker. Louise and her husband did not live happily together, and everyone agreed that she was to blame. She was a small woman with sharp gray eyes and black hair. From childhood, she had been inclined to fits of temper, and when not angry, she was often morose and silent. In Winesburg, it was said that she drank. Her husband, the banker, who was a careful, shrewd man, tried hard to make her happy. When he began to make money, he bought for her a large brick house on Elm Street in Winesburg, and he was the first man in that town to keep a manservant to drive his wife's carriage. But Louise could not be made happy. She flew into half-insane fits of temper, during which she was sometimes silent, sometimes noisy and quarrelsome. She swore and cried out in anger. She got a knife from the kitchen and threatened her husband's life. Once she deliberately set fire to the house, and often she hid herself away for days in her own room and would see no one. Her life, lived as a half-recluse, gave rise to all sorts of stories concerning her. It was said that she took drugs and that she hid herself away from people because she was often so under the influence of drink that her condition could not be concealed. Sometimes on summer afternoons, she came out of the house and got into her carriage. Dismissing the driver, she took the reins in her own hands and drove off at top speed through the streets. If a pedestrian got in her way, she drove straight ahead, and the frightened citizen had to escape as best he could. To the people of the town, it seemed as though she wanted to run them down. When she had driven through several streets, tearing around corners and beating the horses with the whip, she drove off into the country. On the country roads, after she had gotten out of sight of the houses, she let the horses slow down to a walk, and her wild, reckless mood passed. She became thoughtful and muttered words. Sometimes tears came into her eyes. And then, when she came back into town, she again drove furiously through the quiet streets. But for the influence of her husband and the respect he inspired in people's minds, she would have been arrested more than once by the town marshal. Young David Hardy grew up in the house with this woman, and as can well be imagined, there was not much joy in his childhood. He was too young then to have opinions of his own about people, but at times it was difficult for him not to have very definite opinions about the woman who was his mother. David was always a quiet, orderly boy, and for a long time was thought by people of Winesburg to be something of a dullard. His eyes were brown, and as a child, he had a habit of looking at things and people a long time without appearing to see what he was looking at. When he heard his mother spoken of harshly, or when he overheard her berating his father, he was frightened and ran away to hide. Sometimes he could not find a hiding place, and that confused him. Turning his face toward a tree, or if he was indoors, toward the wall, he closed his eyes and tried not to think of anything. He had a habit of talking aloud to himself, and early in life, a spirit of quiet sadness often took possession of him. On the occasion when David went to visit his grandfather on the Bentley farm, he was altogether contented and happy. Often he wished that he would never have to go back to town, and once when he had come home from the farm after a long visit, something happened that had a lasting effect on his mind. David had come back into town with one of the hired men. The man was in a hurry to go about his own affairs, and left the boy at the head of the street in which the Hardy house stood. It was early dusk of a fall evening, and the sky was overcast with clouds. Something happened to David. He could not bear to go into the house where his mother and father lived, and on an impulse, he decided to run away from home. He intended to go back to the farm and to his grandfather, but lost his way, and for hours he wandered, weeping and frightened, on the country roads. It started to rain, and lightning flashed in the sky. The boy's imagination was excited, and he fancied that he could see and hear strange things in the darkness. Into his mind came the conviction that he was walking and running in some terrible void where no one had ever been before. The darkness about him seemed limitless. The sound of the wind blowing in the trees was terrifying. When a team of horses approached along the road in which he walked, he was frightened and climbed a fence. Through a field he ran until he came into another road, and getting upon his knees, felt of the soft ground with his fingers. But for the figure of his grandfather, whom he was afraid he would never find in the darkness, he thought the world must be altogether empty. When his cries were heard by a farmer who was walking home from town, and he was brought back to his father's house, he was so tired and excited that he did not know what was happening to him. By chance, David's father knew that he had disappeared. On the street, he had met the farmhand from the Bentley place and knew of his son's return to town. When the boy did not come home, an alarm was set up, and John Hardy, with several men of the town, went to search the country. The report that David had been kidnapped ran about through the streets of Winesburg. When he came home, there were no lights on in the house, but his mother appeared and clutched him eagerly in her arms. David thought that she had suddenly become another woman. He could not believe that so delightful a thing had happened. With her own hands, Louise Hardy bathed his tired young body and cooked him food. She would not let him go to bed, but when he had put on his nightgown, blew out the lights, and sat down in a chair to hold him in her arms. For an hour, the woman sat in the darkness and held her boy. All the time she kept talking in a low voice. David could not understand what had so changed her. Her habitually dissatisfied face had become, he thought, the most beautiful and lovely thing he had ever seen. When he began to weep, she held him more and more tightly. On and on went her voice. It was not harsh or shrill as when she talked to her husband, but was like rain falling on trees. Presently, the men began coming to the door to report that he had not been found. But she made him hide and be silent until she had sent them away. He thought it must be a game his mother and the men of the town were playing with him, and laughed joyously. Into his mind came the thought that his having been lost and frightened in the darkness was an altogether unimportant matter. He thought that he would have been willing to go through the frightful experience 1,000 times to be sure of finding at the end of the long black road a thing so lovely as his mother had suddenly become. During the last years of young David's boyhood, he saw his mother but seldom, and she became for him just a woman with whom he had once lived. Still, he could not get her figure out of his mind, and as he grew older, it became more definite. When he was 12 years old, he went to the Bentley farm to live. Old Jess came into town and fairly demanded that he be given charge of the boy. The old man was excited and determined on having his own way. He talked to John Hardy in the office of the Winesburg Savings Bank, and then the two men went to the house on Elm Street to talk with Louise. They both expected her to make trouble, but were mistaken. She was very quiet, and when Jess had explained his mission and had gone on at some length about the advantages to come through having the boy out of doors and in the quiet atmosphere of the old house, she nodded her head in approval. "It is an atmosphere not corrupted by my presence," she said sharply. Her shoulders shook, and she seemed about to fly into a fit of temper. "It is a place for a man-child, although it was never a place for me," she went on. "You never wanted me there. And of course, the air of your house did me no good. It was like poison in my blood. But it will be different with him." Louise turned and went out of the room, leaving the two men to sit in embarrassed silence. As very often happened, she later stayed in her room for days. Even when the boy's clothes were packed and he was taken away, she did not appear. The loss of her son made a sharp break in her life, and she seemed less inclined to quarrel with her husband. John Hardy thought it had all turned out very well indeed. And so, young David went to live in the Bentley farmhouse with Jess. Two of the old farmer's sisters were alive and still lived in the house. They were afraid of Jess, and rarely spoke when he was about. One of the women who had been noted for her flaming red hair when she was younger was a born mother and became the boy's caretaker. Every night when he had gone to bed, she went into his room and sat on the floor until he fell asleep. When he became drowsy, she became bold and whispered things that he later thought he must have dreamed. Her low voice called him endearing names, and he dreamed that his mother had come to him and that she had changed so that she was always as she had been that time after he ran away. He also grew bold, and reaching out his hand, stroked the face of the woman on the floor so that she was ecstatically happy. Everyone in the old house became happy after the boy went there. The hard, insistent thing in Jess Bentley that had kept the people in the house silent and timid, and that had never been dispelled by the presence of the girl Louise, was apparently swept away by the coming of the boy. It was as though God had relented and sent a son to the man. The man who had proclaimed himself the only true servant of God in all the valley of Wine Creek, and who had wanted God to send him a sign of approval by way of a son out of the womb of Catherine, began to think that at last his prayers had been answered. Although he was at the time only 55 years old, he looked 70, and was worn out with much thinking and scheming. The effort he had made to extend his land holdings had been successful, and there were few farms in the valley that did not belong to him. But until David came, he was a bitterly disappointed man. There were two influences at work in Jess Bentley, and all his life his mind had been a battleground for these influences. First, there was the old thing in him. He wanted to be a man of God and a leader among men of God. His walking in the fields and through the forests at night had brought him close to nature, and there were forces in the passionately religious man that ran out to the forces of nature. The disappointment that had come to him when a daughter and not a son had been born to Catherine had fallen upon him like a blow struck by some unseen hand, and the blow had somewhat softened his egotism. He still believed that God might at any moment make himself manifest out of the winds or the clouds, but he no longer demanded such recognition. Instead, he prayed for it. Sometimes he was altogether doubtful and thought God had deserted the world. He regretted the fate that had not let him live in a simpler and sweeter time, when at the beckoning of some strange cloud in the sky, men left their lands and houses and went forth into the wilderness to create new races. While he worked night and day to make his farms more productive and to extend his holdings of land, he regretted that he could not use his own restless energy in the building of temples, the slaying of unbelievers, and in general, in the work of glorifying God's name on earth. That is what Jess hungered for, and then also he hungered for something else. He had grown into maturity in America in the years after the Civil War, and he, like all men of his time, had been touched by the deep influences that were at work in the country during those years, when modern industrialism was being born. He began to buy machines that would permit him to do the work of the farms while employing fewer men, and he sometimes thought that if he were a younger man, he would give up farming altogether and start a factory in Winesburg for the making of machinery. Jess formed the habit of reading newspapers and magazines. He invented a machine for the making of fence out of wire. Faintly, he realized that the atmosphere of old times and places that he had always cultivated in his own mind was strange and foreign to the thing that was growing up in the minds of others. The beginning of the most materialistic age in the history of the world, when wars would be fought without patriotism, when men would forget God and only pay attention to moral standards, when the will to power would replace the will to serve, and beauty would be well-nigh forgotten in the terrible headlong rush of mankind toward the acquiring of possessions, was telling its story to Jess, the man of God, as it was to the men about him. The greedy thing in him wanted to make money faster than it could be made by tilling the land. More than once, he went into Winesburg to talk with his son-in-law John Hardy about it.
"You are a banker, and you will have chances I never had," he said, and his eyes shone. "I'm thinking about it all the time. Big things are going to be done in the country, and there will be more money to be made than I ever dreamed of. You get into it. I wish I were younger and had your chance."
Jess Bentley walked up and down in the bank office and grew more and more excited as he talked. At one time in his life, he had been threatened with paralysis, and his left side remained somewhat weakened. As he talked, his left eyelid twitched. Later, when he drove back home, and when night came on and the stars came out, it was hard to get back the old feeling of a close and personal God who lived in the sky overhead and who might at any moment reach out his hand, touch him on the shoulder, and appoint him for some heroic task to be done. Jess's mind was fixed upon the things read in newspapers and magazines, on fortunes to be made, almost without effort, by shrewd men who bought and sold. For him, the coming of the boy David did much to bring back with renewed force the old faith, and it seemed to him that God had at last looked with favor upon him. As for the boy on the farm, life began to reveal itself to him in a thousand new and delightful ways. The kindly attitude of all about him expanded his quiet nature, and he lost the half-timid, hesitating manner he had always had with his people. At night, when he went to bed after a long day of adventures in the stables, in the fields, or driving about from farm to farm with his grandfather, he wanted to embrace everyone in the house. If Shirley Bentley, the woman who came each night to sit on the floor by his bedside, did not appear at once, he went to the head of the stairs and shouted, his young voice ringing through the narrow halls, where for so long there had been a tradition of silence. In the morning, when he awoke and lay still in bed, the sounds that came into him through the windows filled him with delight. He thought with a shudder of life in the house in Winesburg, and of his mother's angry voice that had always made him tremble. There in the country, all sounds were pleasant sounds. When he awoke at dawn, the barnyard back of the house was also awake. In the house, people stirred about. Eliza Stratton, the half-witted girl, was poked in the ribs by a farmhand and giggled noisily. In some distant field, a cow bawled and was answered by the cattle in the stables, and one of the farmhands spoke sharply to the horse he was grooming by the stable door. David leaped out of bed and ran to a window. All of the people stirring about excited his mind, and he wondered what his mother was doing in the house in town. From the windows of his own room, he could not see directly into the barnyard where the farmhands had now all assembled to do the morning chores, but he could hear the voices of the men and the neighing of the horses. When one of the men laughed, He laughed also. Leaning out at the open window, he looked into an orchard where a fat sow wandered about with a litter of tiny pigs at her heels. Every morning he counted the pigs. 4, 5, 6, 7, he said slowly, wetting his fingers and making straight up and down marks on the window ledge. David ran to put on his trousers and shirt. A feverish desire to get out of doors took possession of him. Every morning he made such a noise coming downstairs that Aunt Callie, the housekeeper, declared that he was trying to tear the house down. When he had run through the long old house, shutting the doors behind him with a bang, he came into the barnyard and looked about with an amazed air of expectation. It seemed to him that in such a place tremendous things might have happened during the night. The farmhands looked at him and laughed. Henry Strader, an old man who had been on the farm since Jess came into possession, and who before David's time had never been known to make a joke, made the same joke every morning. It amused David so that he laughed and clapped his hands.
"See, come here and look," cried the old man. "Grandfather Jess's white mare has torn the black stocking she wears on her foot."
Day after day through the long summer, Jess Bentley drove from farm to farm, up and down the valley of Wine Creek, and his grandson went with him. They rode in a comfortable old phaeton drawn by the white horse. The old man scratched his thin white beard and talked to himself of his plans for increasing the productiveness of the fields they visited and of God's part in the plans all men made. Sometimes he looked at David and smiled happily, and then, for a long time, he appeared to forget the boy's existence. More and more every day now, his mind turned back again to the dreams that had filled his mind when he first came out of the city to live on the land. One afternoon, he startled David by letting his dreams take entire possession of him. With the boy as a witness, he went through a ceremony and brought about an accident that nearly destroyed the companionship that was growing up between them. Jess and his grandson were driving in a distant part of the valley, some miles from home. A forest came down to the road, and through the forest, Wine Creek wriggled its way over the stones toward a distant river. All the afternoon, Jess had been in a meditative mood, and now he began to talk. His mind went back to the night when he had been frightened by thoughts of a giant that would come to rob and plunder him of his possessions. And again, as on that night, when he had run through the fields crying for a son, he became excited to the edge of insanity. Stopping the horse, he got out of the buggy and asked David to get out also. The two climbed over a fence and walked along the back of the stream. The boy paid no attention to the muttering of his grandfather, but ran along beside him and wondered what was going to happen. When a rabbit jumped up and ran through the woods, he clapped his hands and danced with delight. He looked up at the tall trees and was sorry that he was not a little animal to climb high in the air without being frightened. Stooping, he picked up a small stone and threw it over the head of his grandfather into a clump of bushes.
"Wake up, little animal! Go and climb to the top of the trees!" he shouted in a shrill voice.
Jess Bentley went along under the trees with his head bowed and with his mind in a ferment. His earnestness affected the boy, who presently became silent and a little alarmed. Into the old man's mind had come the notion that now he could bring from God a word or a sign out of the sky, that the presence of the boy and man on their knees in some lonely spot in the forest would make the miracle he had been waiting for almost inevitable.
"It was just such a place as this that other David tended the sheep when his father came and told him to go down into Saul," he muttered.
Taking the boy rather roughly by the shoulder, he climbed over a fallen log, and when he had come to an open place among the trees, he dropped upon his knees and began to pray in a loud voice. A kind of terror he had never known before took possession of David. Crouching beneath the tree, he watched the man on the ground before him, and his own knees began to tremble. It seemed to him that he was in the presence not only of his grandfather, but of someone else,
someone who might hurt him. Someone who was not kindly, but dangerous and brutal. He began to cry, and reaching down, picked up a small stick, which he held tightly gripped in his fingers. When Jess Bentley, absorbed in his own idea, suddenly arose and advanced toward him, his terror grew until his whole body shook. In the woods, an intense silence seemed to lie over everything, and suddenly, out of the silence, came the old man's harsh and insistent voice. Gripping the boy's shoulders, Jess turned his face to the sky and shouted. The whole left side of his face twitched, and his hand on the boy's shoulder twitched also.
"Make a sign to me, God," he cried. "Here I stand with the boy David. Come down to me out of the sky, and make thy presence known to me."
With a cry of fear, David turned, and shaking himself loose from the hands that held him, ran away through the forest. He did not believe that the man who turned up his face and in a harsh voice shouted at the sky was his grandfather at all. The man did not look like his grandfather. The conviction that something strange and terrible had happened, that by some miracle a new and dangerous person had come into the body of the kindly old man, took possession of him. On and on he ran down the hillside, sobbing as he ran. When he fell over the roots of a tree, and in falling struck his head, he arose and tried to run on again. His head hurt, so that presently he fell down and lay still. But it was only after Jess had carried him to the buggy, and he awoke to find the old man's hand stroking his head tenderly, that the terror left him.
"Take me away! There is a terrible man back there in the woods," he declared firmly, while Jess looked away over the tops of the trees, and again his lips cried out to God.
"What have I done that thou dost not approve of me?"
he whispered softly, saying the words over and over as he drove rapidly along the road, with the boy's cut and bleeding head held tenderly against his shoulder. And now, Godliness, Part 3, Surrender, Concerning Louise Bentley. The story of Louise Bentley, who became Mrs. John Hardy and lived with her husband in a brick house on Elm Street in Winesburg, is a story of misunderstanding. Before such women as Louise can be understood and their lives made livable, much will have to be done. Thoughtful books will have to be written, and thoughtful lives lived by people about them. Born of a delicate and overworked mother and an impulsive, hard, imaginative father who did not look with favor upon her coming into the world, Louise was from childhood a neurotic, one of the race of oversensitive women that in later days industrialism was to bring in such great numbers into the world. During her early years, she lived on the Bentley farm, a silent, moody child, wanting love more than anything else in the world, and not getting it. When she was 15, she went to live in Winesburg with the family of Albert Hardy, who had a store for the sale of buggies and wagons, and who was a member of the town board of education. Louise went into town to be a student in the Winesburg High School, and she went to live at the Hardys because Albert Hardy and her father were friends. Hardy, the vehicle merchant of Winesburg, like thousands of other men of his times, was an enthusiast on the subject of education. He had made his own way in the world without learning got from books, but he was convinced that had he but known books, things would have gone better with him. To everyone who came into his shop, he talked of the matter, and in his own household, he drove his family distracted by his constant harping on the subject. He had two daughters and one son, John Hardy, and more than once the daughters threatened to leave school altogether. As a matter of principle, they did just enough work in their classes to avoid punishment.
"I hate books, and I hate anyone who likes books,"
Harriet, the younger of the two girls, declared passionately. In Winesburg, as on the farm, Louise was not happy. For years she had dreamed of the time when she could go forth into the world, and she looked upon the move into the Hardy household as a great step in the direction of freedom. Always when she had thought of the matter,
It seemed to her that in town all must be gaiety and life, that there men and women must live happily and freely, giving and taking friendship and affection, as one takes the feel of a wind on the cheek. After the silence and cheerlessness of life in the Bentley house, she dreamed of stepping forth into an atmosphere that was warm and pulsating with life and reality. And in the Hardy household, Louise might have got something of the thing for which she so hungered, but for a mistake she made when she had just come to town. Louise won the disfavor of the two Hardy girls, Mary and Harriet, by her application to her studies in school. She did not come to the house until the day when school was to begin, and knew nothing of the feeling they had in the matter. She was timid, and during the first month made no acquaintances. Every Friday afternoon, one of the hired men from the farm drove into Winesburg and took her home for the weekend, so that she did not spend the Saturday holiday with the town people. Because she was embarrassed and lonely, she worked constantly at her studies. To Mary and Harriet, it seemed as though she tried to make trouble for them by her proficiency. In her eagerness to appear well, Louise wanted to answer every question put to the class by the teacher. She jumped up and down, and her eyes flashed. Then, when she had answered some question the others in the class had been unable to answer, she smiled happily. "See, I've done it for you," her eyes seemed to say. "You need not bother about the matter. I will answer all questions. For the whole class, it will be easy while I'm here." In the evening, after supper in the Hardy house, Albert Hardy began to praise Louise. One of the teachers had spoken highly of her, and he was delighted.
"Well, again I have heard of it,"
he began, looking hard at his daughters, and then turning to smile at Louise.
"Another of the teachers has told me of the good work Louise is doing. Everyone in Winesburg is telling me how smart she is. I am ashamed that they do not speak so of my own girls."
Arising, the merchant marched about the room and lighted his evening cigar. The two girls looked at each other and shook their heads wearily. Seeing their indifference, the father became angry.
"I tell you, it is something for you two to be thinking about," he cried, glaring at them. "There's a big change coming here in America, and in learning is the only hope of the coming generations. Louise is the daughter of a rich man, but she is not ashamed to study. It should make you ashamed to see what she does."
The merchant took his hat from a rack by the door and prepared to depart for the evening. At the door, he stopped and glared back. So fierce was his manner that Louise was frightened and ran upstairs to her own room. The daughters began to speak of their own affairs.
"Pay attention to me," roared the merchant. "Your minds are lazy. Your indifference to education is affecting your character. You will amount to nothing. Now mark what I say. Louise will be so far ahead of you that you will never catch up."
The distracted man went out of the house and into the street, shaking with wrath. He went along muttering words and swearing, but when he got into Main Street, his anger passed. He stopped to talk of the weather or the crops, with some other merchant or with a farmer who had come into town, and forgot his daughters altogether. Or if he thought of them, he only shrugged his shoulders.
"Oh, well, girls will be girls,"
he muttered philosophically. In the house, when Louise came down into the room where the two girls sat, they would have nothing to do with her. One evening, after she had been there for more than 6 weeks and was heartbroken because of the continued air of coldness with which she was always greeted, she burst into tears.
"Shut up your crying and go back to your own room and to your books,"
Mary Hardy said sharply. The room occupied by Louise was on the second floor of the Hardy house, and her window looked out upon an orchard. There was a stove in the room, and every evening John Hardy carried up an armful of wood and put it in a box that stood by the wall. During the second month after she came to the house, Louise gave up all hope of getting on friendly footing with the Hardy girls and went to her own room as soon as the evening meal was at an end. Her mind began to play with thoughts of making friends with John Hardy.
When he came into the room with the wood in his arms, she pretended to be busy with her studies, but watched him eagerly. When he had put the wood in the box and turned to go out, she put her head down and blushed. She tried to make talk, but could say nothing. And after he had gone, she was angry at herself for her stupidity. The mind of the country girl became filled with the idea of drawing close to the young man. She thought that in him might be found the quality she had all her life been seeking in people. It seemed to her that between herself and all the other people in the world, a wall had been built up, and that she was living just on the edge of some warm inner circle of life that must be quite open and understandable to others. She became obsessed with the thought that it wanted but a courageous act on her part to make all of her association with people something quite different, and that it was possible by such an act to pass into a new life as one opens a door and goes into a room. Day and night she thought of the matter. But although the thing she wanted so earnestly was something very warm and close, it had, as yet, no conscious connection with sex. It had not become that definite, and her mind had only alighted upon the person of John Hardy because he was at hand, and unlike his sisters, had not been unfriendly to her. The Hardy sisters, Mary and Harriet, were both older than Louise. In a certain kind of knowledge of the world, they were years older. They lived as all of the young women of Middle Western towns lived. In those days, young women did not go out of our towns to Eastern colleges, and ideas in regard to social classes had hardly begun to exist. A daughter of a laborer was in much the same social position as a daughter of a farmer or a merchant, and there were no leisure classes. A girl was nice, or she was not nice. If a nice girl, she had a young man who came to her house to see her on Sunday and Wednesday evenings. Sometimes she went with her young man to a dance or a church social. At other times she received him at the house and was given the use of the parlor for that purpose. No one intruded upon her. For hours the two sat behind closed doors. Sometimes the lights were turned low, and the young man and woman embraced. Cheeks became hot, and hair disarranged. After a year or two, if the impulse within them became strong and insistent enough, they married. One evening during her first winter in Winesburg, Louise had an adventure that gave a new impulse to her desire to break down the wall that she thought stood between her and John Hardy. It was Wednesday, and immediately after the evening meal, Albert Hardy put on his hat and went away. Young John brought the wood and put it in the box in Louise's room.
"You do work hard, don't you?"
he said awkwardly, and then before she could answer, he also went away. Louise heard him go out of the house and had a mad desire to run after him. Opening her window, she leaned out and called softly,
"John, dear John, come back. Don't go away."
The night was cloudy, and she could not see far into the darkness. But as she waited, she fancied she could hear a soft little noise, as of someone going on tiptoes through the trees in the orchard. She was frightened and closed the window quickly. For an hour she moved about the room trembling with excitement, and when she could no longer bear the waiting, she crept into the hall and down the stairs into a closet-like room that opened off the parlor. Louise had decided that she would perform the courageous act that had for weeks been in her mind. She was convinced that John Hardy had concealed himself in the orchard beneath her window, and she was determined to find him and tell him that she wanted him to come close to her, to hold her in his arms, to tell her of his thoughts and dreams, and to listen while she told him her thoughts and dreams.
"In the darkness, it will be easier to say things," she whispered to herself as she stood in the little room groping for the door.
And then suddenly, Louise realized that she was not alone in the house. In the parlor on the other side of the door, a man's voice spoke softly, and the door opened. Louise just had time to conceal herself in a little opening beneath the stairway
when Mary Hardy, accompanied by her young man, came into the little dark room. For an hour, Louise sat on the floor in the darkness and listened. Without words, Mary Hardy, with the aid of the man who had come to spend the evening with her, brought into the country girl a knowledge of men and women. Putting her head down until she was curled into a little ball, she lay perfectly still. It seemed to her that by some strange impulse of the gods, a great gift had been brought to Mary, and she could not understand the older woman's determined protest. The young man took Mary Hardy into his arms and kissed her. When she struggled and laughed, he but held her the more tightly. For an hour the contest between them went on, and then they went back into the parlor, and Louise escaped up the stairs.
"I hope you were quiet out there. You must not disturb the little mouse at her studies,"
she heard Harriet saying to her sister as she stood by her own door in the hallway above. Louise wrote a note to John Hardy, and late that night, when all the house were asleep, she crept downstairs and slipped it under his door. She was afraid that if she did not do the thing at once, her courage would fail. In the note, she tried to be quite definite about what she wanted.
"I want someone to love me, and I want to love someone," she wrote. "If you are the one for me, I want you to come into the orchard at night and make a noise under my window. It will be easy for me to crawl down over the shed and come to you. I am thinking about it all the time, so if you are to come at all, you must come soon."
For a long time, Louise did not know what would be the outcome of her bold attempt to secure for herself a lover. In a way, she still did not know whether or not she wanted him to come. Sometimes it seemed to her that to be held tightly and kissed was the whole secret of life, and then a new impulse came and she was terribly afraid. The age-old woman's desire to be possessed had taken possession of her. But so vague was her notion of life that it seemed to her just the touch of Hardy's hand upon her own hand would satisfy. She wondered if he would understand that. At the table the next day, while Albert Hardy talked and the two girls whispered and laughed, she did not look at John, but at the table, and as soon as possible escaped. In the evening, she went out of the house until she was sure he had taken the wood to her room and gone away. When, after several evenings of intense listening, she heard no call from the darkness in the orchard, she was half beside herself with grief and decided that for her, there was no way to break through the wall that had shut her off from the joy of life. And then, on a Monday evening, 2 or 3 weeks after the writing of the note, John Hardy came for her. Louise had so entirely given up the thought of his coming that for a long time she did not hear the call that came up from the orchard. On the Friday evening before, as she was being driven back to the farm for the weekend by one of the hired men, she had, on an impulse, done a thing that had startled her, and as John Hardy stood in the darkness below and called her name softly and insistently, she walked about in her room and wondered what new impulse had led her to commit so ridiculous an act. The farmhand, a young fellow with black curly hair, had come for her somewhat late on that Friday evening, and they drove home in the darkness. Louise, whose mind was filled with thoughts of John Hardy, tried to make talk, but the country boy was embarrassed and would say nothing. Her mind began to review the loneliness of her childhood, and she remembered with a pang the sharp new loneliness that had just come to her. "I hate everyone," she cried suddenly, and then broke forth into a tirade that frightened her escort. "I hate Father and the old man Hardy, too," she declared vehemently. "I get my lessons there in the school in town, but I hate that also." Louise frightened the farmhand still more by turning and putting her cheek down upon his shoulder. Vaguely, she hoped that he, like that young man who had stood in the darkness with Mary, would put his arms about her and kiss her. But the country boy was only alarmed. He struck the horse with the whip and began to whistle. "The road is rough, eh?" he said loudly. Louise was so angry
that, reaching up, she snatched his hat from his head and threw it into the road. When he jumped out of the buggy and went to get it, she drove off and left him to walk the rest of the way back to the farm. Louise Bentley took John Hardy to be her lover. That was not what she wanted. But it was so the young man had interpreted her approach to him, and so anxious was she to achieve something else that she made no resistance. When, after a few months, they were both afraid that she was about to become a mother, they went one evening to the county seat and were married. For a few months, they lived in the Hardy house, and then took a house of their own. All during the first year, Louise tried to make her husband understand the vague and intangible hunger that had led to the writing of the note, and that was still unsatisfied. Again and again, she crept into his arms and tried to talk of it, but always without success. Filled with his own notions of love between men and women, he did not listen, but began to kiss her upon the lips. That confused her so that in the end, she did not want to be kissed. She did not know what she wanted. When the alarm that had tricked them into marriage proved to be groundless, she was angry and said bitter, hurtful things. Later, when her son David was born, she could not nurse him and did not know whether she wanted him or not. Sometimes she stayed in the room with him all day, walking about and occasionally creeping close to touch him tenderly with her hands. And then other days came when she did not want to see or be near the tiny bit of humanity that had come into the house. When John Hardy reproached her for her cruelty, she laughed. "It is a man-child, and will get what it wants anyway," she said sharply. "Had it been a woman-child, there is nothing in the world I would not have done for it." And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Godliness, Parts 2 and 3, from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwin Anderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.